This podcast was recorded at the 2016 JADPRO Live at AppShow Conference in Washington, D.C. The title of this session is Management of Venous Thromboembolism for Patients with Hematologic Malignancies, and it is presented by Rowena N. Schwartz, University of Cincinnati. To view the presentation material or see other topics of interest, please visit advancedpractitioner.com/sessions2016. To claim continuing educational credit for these activities, visit education.annenberg.net/JPL16-sessions. And now, we're delighted to bring you this podcast from JADPRO Live.
This is entitled The Management of Venous Thromboembolism for Patients with Hematological Malignancies. Please join me in welcoming our speaker, Dr. Rowena Schwartz, who is an associate professor of pharmacy at the University of Cincinnati.
This is a topic, coagulation in cancer, I think is a fascinating topic. I think it's a broad topic. When we usually talk about different issues in oncology, we usually talk about treatment of disease or treatment of a complication of a disease. And lately, in the last couple of years, we talk about comorbidities in patients. When we talk about VTE in cancer patients, we're hitting all three. We're talking about being caused by the cancer, not being caused by the treatment, and the fact that many people come in with the risk of VTE and having VTE. So anyhow, what I was trying to say is that this is like a major topic. So one of the things that we're going to do is we're going to go over some of the basics, and I want to take that opportunity to talk about nuances that are important in oncology and in cancer. Let's get slides. And the key thing that when we talk about these issues, I want you to think about what you see in your patients, because one of the things that is very clear is that how we manage patients with thrombosis is evolving. We are learning much more about the etiology and how we can treat, and I want you to think of those things. So at the end, instead of like asking me questions, I would open it up to where we can have some discussion. So write that down. No questions at the end. Talk to each other. So. Little joke. So here's our learning objectives for today, and that is that we're going to really talk about the risk factors for VTE in this population, talk just a little bit about prophylaxis, really going to focus on treatment. We're going to talk about the options that are available and how those options for VTE fit in the treatment of VTE related to malignancy. And so one of the key things that you're going to notice is what we're going to talk about is probably not necessarily what you see in practice. I think that's important to understand. How we monitor response, and then talk about some of the antidotes. The key thing here is that what I say is probably not going to hit the depth of what you want to know in practice, so I really did a lot of references that are reviews. So use those reviews. If you have a topic you want to know, go and get that paper, because that's probably the best information. The other thing I did is I really leaned a lot on the guidelines that are available. So instead of taking things from what I think is my idea of what practice should be, I actually went to what experts' ideas of what practice should be. Figure that. So that those are available as well. So with that, I have nothing to disclose at this time. Maybe tomorrow. I might buy some stock. We'll see. If you look at what we're going to talk about, as I mentioned, we're going to focus on VTE, mainly deep vein thrombosis and PE. Key thing is that does not even begin to stretch all the types of VTE that you can see in patients with malignancy. The NCCN guidelines on VTE do a nice job of looking at subsets of types of thrombosis and the things that you need to consider for those different subsets. The other thing that you'll see more in the literature now is a talk about the timing, and that's really changing. So we often talk about acute management of VTE as being that first 5 to 7 days that historically we used a parenteral anticoagulant. Well, that's a little bit changing now with some of the treatment options for VTE, maybe not in malignancy, but for the sake of this discussion, acute management will be that time. And then if you look at short term, some people call it chronic, but short-term is 3 to 6 months. And the issue that becomes really a challenge in patients with malignancy is the long-term treatment, and that's beyond the 6 months. So when I used to work in an anticoagulation clinic in an oncology center, one of our biggest things was people really wanted to do that 3 to 6 months and didn't think of the long-term risk of our patients. More and more of our patients have
chronic cancer. And so when they have VTE, their risk for VTE is a chronic disease just like their cancer is. And that really has changed how we used to look at treatment of VTE and say someone who had lung cancer that did not have the longevity that we see now. And then let's just go right into homeostasis, which I think you guys are pretty well aware of. This is a simplistic picture I put together many years ago, and it just goes over some of the process that we see. I use it for a couple of key reasons. One is this is a good way to talk about the natural inhibitors of clotting. And so one of the things that we're going to talk about when we mention warfarin is we're going to talk about its effect on some of these natural anticoagulant, protein C and protein S. If you go through this process, it's what you remember with the cell cycle, clotting cascade, and every other diagram in school that you really didn't want to learn because all you wanted to know is how you treat this, but that's what this diagram is. And you can see we go up here, we have vessel wall injury. When the vessel wall is injured, you get initial vasoconstriction. Then you get aggregation of platelets because of this release of the natural activators with von Willebrand's factor. With that, the platelets then degranulate, and ADP, thromboxane, A2, is released, and this causes the formation of this this clot. You get adhesion, and then you get, from this clot, you get the cascade of the coagulation cascade. And we'll talk a little bit more about that, both the intrinsic and the extrinsic. From that, you get thrombin formation, which then causes fibrin formation, and then you get stabilization of the clot. And this is all very, should be a review for most of you. These are some of the natural anticoagulants, and I show this as a slide simply to remind you of these proteins CNS and to talk about antithrombin 3, to remember that these are natural anticoagulants because they do, the drugs we use impact these anticoagulants. Okay, this is the diagram that I think everyone really enjoys looking at. I think that the only one I like better is the cell cycle, and if you gave me the cell cycle, I really would be quite excited. So if you look at this, and I think you're all very familiar with it, just a couple key things here. So you can see that this tissue factor, which is actually factor 3, when it's released with the injury to that vessel, that actually starts the extrinsic pathway. The extrinsic pathway is also called tissue factor pathway. It's a really rapidly acting response, and it forms a relatively small clot. With damage to the surface, you get the intrinsic. Did I just say intrinsic when I was pointing to extrinsic? I meant extrinsic. Intrinsic pathway develops that bigger, more solid clot, and then you go to the common pathway where you get prothrombin made to thrombin, fibrinogen to fibrin, and then you get the formation of the clot. This is one of the main targets of our therapies, and so this cascade we'll see again and again and again. If you look at some of the nomenclature that you'll have within your slides, I just wanted to mention UFH stands for unfractionated heparin, low molecular weight heparin, you all know. But I really wanted to talk about the naming that is out there now and some of the controversy about the new oral anticoagulants. And so when I say new oral anticoagulants, it depends on when you started practice. So for me, they're brand new oral anticoagulants. For some of you, they're like they were out for 10 years before I was born. So this is really one of the reasons why people don't like to call them NOACs because they're not new or novel anymore because they have been developed and being used. Another terminology that you may see is this direct because these are the agents that work directly on these factors versus some of our older agents like heparin and warfarin. They have indirect effect on coagulation where these new agents are more targeted. So, you know, target. You're going to see targets here too. So it's truly an oncology talk because we're talking targets. And then the other thing is that there was big controversy, and I just gave you the reference where they talk about what the naming should be. I'm not going to refer to them as direct or new. What I'm going to refer to them as is by their mechanism of action because I think that's important for understanding. I learned that lesson when I did antiemetics. It's important to know how drugs are grouped together, so if you try one and you want to try a different one, you want to know the different mechanism of action. So this is the other obligatory slide that you have to have in a talk about thrombosis, and that's Virchow's triad. Virchow was a Prussian physician who is attributed to having determined this triad. That's actually not true. What he did determine is the factors that are important to take a thrombosis to an embolism. He was very enthralled by why that occurred, and he identified those factors. So he's the father of cellular pathology, and he's attributed with this triad, but really what he did is identify, just like we need to identify, those factors in patients that play a role in identifying problems. So that's going to be one of my key things I'm going to say to you today. There is not enough understanding of specific cancers, specific treatments, and specific populations to know how we should modify our treatment today. So one of the things that you can do in practice is when you see something, identify it and look at it and evaluate it, because that's the only way that we learn further. So I give that to you as a challenge. So if you look at the three factors I think you're all very well aware of, stasis, hypercoagulable, and endothelial injury. This is a slide that talks about why cancer has an increased risk of coagulopathy. And the key thing here is that this slide makes it sound like cancer, increased risk. And the reality of it is, pancreatic cancer is not glioma, is not lung cancer, is not breast cancer. So when you look at increased risk, the pathophysiology of the increased risk of clots in patients with cancer is determined somewhat by the cancer itself. So it's really important that we've simplified things a lot, but probably too much. So this is a great thing to say that there are cytokines that are important and they're procoagulants, but the reality, we really need to learn more about those cancers and what causes it in specific types of cancer. In fact, it's not even just cancer, it's also in the histology of those cancers. This is taken from a study that was published, I think, in 2007, and it was a retrospective analysis of outpatient medical patients to see what their risk of clots were, and it was in inpatient, hospitalized patients. And so you can see, first of all, a couple key things. It's from the early 2000s, which I think was just like yesterday, but others of you may not. So it was just a few years ago in my mind. But the key thing is that does not separate the risk based on the cancer, based on the patient population, based on what treatment they were receiving. So this is not to give you the absolute risk. This is to give you an idea of what patient populations are at high risk. And if you look at this, I bet most of you would pick out the ones that you see that you think of are high risk. So working in an anticoagulation center, what I saw pancreatic cancer, I saw colon cancer, and I saw something no one ever told me I would see, and I saw glioma. Those were patients I saw that were at very high risk. And you can see if you pick those out. Now, if you look at, for this, we're going to focus a little bit on hematologic. So one of the ways that we will do it is if you look here, you can look at lymphoma. The key thing with lymphoma is, lymphoma is not lymphoma. So really, this increased risk is with high-grade lymphoma, which is a very small population of what we see. And the increased leukemia risk is actually with APML, again, a very small population of what we see. So really, these numbers give you like a nice idea, but when you watch in practice, you'll identify those patients that are at risk. And so disease separated from treatment is a little difficult, and if you look back over time, how we treat lymphoma today is not how we treated lymphoma 10 years ago, so you can see that that is changing. And that's one of the things I would encourage you as well. As new treatments are coming onto the market in a plethora of new agents, it's important to look at what the risks are with these patients as we're using them. This is risk factors for VTE. I was new at Cincinnati. I had some time. I decided to do creative slide. Probably not as good as I thought it was at the time, but I was bored and I had a new office, okay? So these are some of the risk factors that you see for VTE. And you can pick these out. Age is one. I love that I made happy people because I think aging is fun. History of VTE, certainly a high risk factor. Vascular stasis. Now this is just general VTE. Hypercoagulable state and medication. So if we take that and we take it to the individual with cancer, you can kind of separate it into three big buckets. One is in patient-related factors, one is in cancer-related factors, and one is in treatment-related factors. And if you look at these, you can see that one population, you cannot define what their risk factor is, and it really has to be individualized. So when I look at these, a couple things I really want to bring out. There are patient-related factors that are modifiable, such as smoking and alcohol and increased exercise. I'm not up here preaching about them. I don't smoke. I don't drink a lot. And I used to exercise. So it's really hard for me to preach that. But it's really important to realize that there are modifiable factors, and that these are factors that in our population of individuals with cancer, perhaps we should be doing a better job at talking to them about the risk of VTE and what they can do to modify that risk. If you look at cancer-related, we already talked about malignancy. If you look, adeno is increased for squamous cell, and that makes sense because a lot of adenocarcinoma are mucin-producing. But the other issue that's really important and becomes an issue when you talk about treatment is the volume of disease. So advanced disease is very different than localized disease. So one of the reasons I say that, when you're making a treatment decision and you're thinking of how aggressive you're going to be, someone who has advanced disease that is maybe getting worse, you may be more aggressive than someone who has, you know, disease that you're treating and is going to go away. So it's really important to look at where patients are in their treatments and how they're responding. In terms of treatment-related surgery, chemotherapy, we don't know which ones, but chemotherapy, endocrine therapies, especially estrogen, specific therapies are a risk factor, central venous access devices, and then anti-angiogenesis agents, and we'll talk about these a little bit later. So there are predictive models to try to determine for a patient receiving chemotherapy in the ambulatory setting what their risk is of having VTE. So this is, I didn't know if this was the best way to put it, so we'll do it both. These are the characteristics that have been looked at. And if you can look at this, it does not hit many of the patients that you see, correct? But you can see that if you have a score of greater than 3, you have a high risk, 7 to 41%. This is, you know, well done work defining risk, but it doesn't hit all the patients that we see. So again, this is like my ask, that there is a lot of potential to look at the patients you see that have VTE to contribute to this literature. And I'm saying you should contribute to the literature, not me. I just want to make that clear. Okay. So let's go to the clinical issues. If you look at the clinical issues, the key things I think we can talk about are, who do we prevent? Who do we do primary prevention? And that's an area that I don't think that we've done well with yet. And then once we diagnose, who do we treat? And then how long do we treat? And how do we manage those patients? So let's start with just some of the symptoms. This is stuff that is like second nature to you, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on it. You can look at the signs and symptoms. You'll recognize most of them. A couple key things I wanted to bring out here just from practice is face swelling, catheter dysfunction. These are two key things to look at if there's catheter-related thrombosis. The issue is that a fibrin clot does not make it a VTE. If you have a clot in the catheter, it does not necessarily make it a VTE. But these are high-risk factors when you see them, a potential evaluation for VTE. When you look at DVT, the thing that I would say in practice is the most challenging. So I was just telling somebody, I just started at the University of Cincinnati, and so my credentialing and stuff is just going through. So they let me shadow somebody finally this week. So I went into a clinic and saw patients. I don't think that they were used to somebody being that excited to see a patient before. But anyhow, I went in, and one of the fellows was talking about a patient who had leg swelling. And he said, you know, but he's had leg swelling before because he's getting immunotherapy, so it's no big deal. One of the biggest challenges with VTE symptom identification is that they overlap so much with what we see in disease. And I've seen this with pain as well. When you have it and you evaluate it and it's negative, you tend to walk away from it and think, I did it once. But the reality of it is, you can't just do it once, and it's a hard decision. How often do you do it? You look at guidelines, it says do it. If it comes back negative, go back, evaluate it again. But that's it. But you and I both know that, you know, it's not a week that you're seeing a patient, you're seeing them over years. So one of the big challenges I think that we see with actually diagnosis is getting in this field that we know with a patient. So if a patient has leg swelling, they're really at risk for clot because of the whole issue of compression. So it may be that when you do the initial evaluation, it's fine. But down the line, it may need to be evaluated again. The other thing is that when you talk about pain and warmth, patients that are on pain medications, patients that are taking non-steroidals or acetaminophen because of, you know, symptoms they're having with chemotherapy, patients on steroids for their antiemetic, you may be masking some of these signs that you normally see. So I think one of the key things here is being very aware of the signs, and I think we really need to identify risk factor identification for certain populations. I did want to mention superficial vein thrombosis for a couple key reasons. One of these are usually have a negative ultrasound when you do it for DVT, but they can be very uncomfortable for patients. So these are patients that we often do use things like warmth and non-steroidals. But it depends on where that thrombosis is, if there is a risk for subsequent DVT. So it's not like a superficial vein thrombosis should not be treated. You really need to look at the location to make a good determination if anticoagulation is required. And the NCCN guidelines in one of their many algorithms does talk about what patients you should consider anticoagulation for, even with a superficial vein thrombosis. Presentations of PE, again, something that you probably all recognize. And the key thing I'm going to say with this is that when you look at the presentation of PE, if you think DVT is hard to recognize in a patient population, PE is really hard to recognize. If you look at these symptoms, I've had a chronic cough for the last six weeks, and I did ask my husband if I should probably be evaluated. He's a nurse. He told me no and quit being such a, I think hypochondriac would be the word he used. I think about it a lot. So, you know, I do exercise, so I don't think I have a high risk. But if you look at all of these type of symptoms, they're really challenging. And where this is a real problem, I think, is an outpatient, because it's not us recognizing the risk. It's teaching patients and their families that they need to call in with these symptoms. So looking at the evaluation, CTA is what's recommended, VQ scan can be used, and where a pulmonary angiogram is probably used is only when there's going to be a when they're going to do thrombolytic extraction or therapy. Okay, assessment for risk for VTE. One of the real hot topics in the general medicine literature about thrombosis is the use of tests to help identify when patients have symptoms if they should be evaluated. And I'll just start off by saying that the use of such tests could be very helpful so that we don't have to keep reevaluating the same way when people come back negative. The problem with this, and I'll just say this up front to give you the bottom line, is that this is not data that has been looked at in the cancer population. And so when you read this, realize that the subset of oncology patients doesn't fit so nicely in it. So there's a number of different strategies that have been used. Use of D-dimer, and we'll talk about that in a minute. The use of probability assessment, the Wells model is what I have in my handout and what I will show you, as well as clinical decision support tools like the pulmonary embolus rule-out criteria. So this is the Wells criteria looking at clinical DVT model. And you can see that active cancer is in it. And you can see that if you look at it closely, you can see a score of 1 or 2 indicates moderate risk, score of 3 or higher, high risk for DVT. This is the model that was used for PE. And again, you can see active cancer, increased risk. But when they did an evaluation of this, looking at it for oncology patients or patients with cancer. In the blue, it says, in various clinically important subgroups, such as patients with cancer, the validity of the Wells rule is questioned. So these criteria really are not as helpful. That being said, the question of D-dimer comes up. D-dimer is really being looked at as a way to determine if there is a risk of clot. But in cancer patients, D-dimer is often elevated because of the inflammation and may not be very helpful. I have seen D-dimer be used in patients, and it's usually in patients who have active cancer treated, have had a clot, and the determination when they are disease-free if there is a recurrence of the clots when there is a clinical sign or symptom. What does that say to you? That D-dimer is not, at this time, a great criteria to use. But I wanted to mention it because you're seeing it a lot in the literature about VTE. And this went back to what we talked about already. Okay. Management options for VTE. So if you look at management options, let's go to the first. One of the first ways that we can do management is to just decrease the risk of a DVT going to the lung, and doing an IVC filter is a strategy. And I wanted to take a minute to talk about this because in practice I think it's one of the things that is used a little freely, and there's dangers associated with it. When you do an IVC filter, it does not decrease the risk of VTE. It decreases the risk of a PE, but it actually can make VTE worse because you're putting a foreign substance in the IVC filter. When you put an IVC filter in, you have a period of time when you can retrieve them, if it's a retrievable time, and if you can't retrieve them, patients can have them forever. And so that can be somewhat of a problem. So IVC filters have a place in therapy, but there are risks associated with them. So where we really look at is how we can manipulate the anticoagulation cascade, and that's going to be one of our big targets. And the other way is how we can manipulate the development of those factors. So I'm going to tell you a story here. My first job, I was at University of Pittsburgh, and they asked me to teach in a chemotherapy course. And I did all these, great overheads. That'll date me. And so when I did these overheads, they had all these diagrams on them. I love them. Afterwards, the instructor took me on the side and said, you need to cut those structures. So now I've learned to just put them in to appease myself. So don't worry about them. Just know that this is for me. So, okay, so let's look at what we have in terms of options. So we have heparin, factor 10A inhibitors, vitamin K antagonists, and direct thrombin inhibitors. And that's how I want you to think about them. And because of time, we're going to go through these relatively fast because I think they're drugs most of you know relatively well. So heparin, we have unfractionated heparin, and we have low molecular weight heparin. It binds, it activates antithrombin 3, and heparin then binds thrombin. So heparin's a big molecule, binds thrombin and antithrombin 3. Unfractionated heparin are smaller molecules, does not bind like thrombin, it binds antithrombin 3. Now, why am I telling you this? Because the mechanism of action of heparin is that it binds antithrombin and thrombin. It therefore has effect on thrombin, factor 10, factor 10A, and a number of other of the clotting factors, not as much. So when you look at heparin, unfractionated heparin, factor 10A and thrombin. Low molecular weight heparin, because it's smaller, does not have that effect on thrombin and has it mainly on factor 10A. When we monitor the effects from heparin, we use APTT because that's basically a measurement of the intrinsic and common pathways, and it measures thrombin. But low molecular weight heparin, because it doesn't have as much of an effect on thrombin, APTT is not as helpful. So that's why low molecular weight heparin is a heparin, but a smaller molecule. So administration, I think you probably all know this. Key thing with heparin to realize is that it's fast onset, fast working. So when you have a patient that's symptomatic, it is something that will work almost immediately. Because of its short half-life, when you stop it, it stops. In a hematologic patient who has high risk of bleeding, it is something that you can shut off relatively fast. It is also a great option for someone who has to be anticoagulated up into a procedure almost to the minute because you can shut it off and do the procedure. And so you can sit there and think a day, 2 days off anticoagulation before a big procedure, not a big risk. I have a friend who had a procedure and had secondary thrombosis during the day and a half she was off anticoagulation because it was a relatively aggressive procedure. So it's really important to realize that heparin has really some nice opportunities. If you look at the side effects bleeding, I think you can all tell me about the bleeding you see with heparin. So let's talk about some of the couple of other things, and that is HIT and osteoporosis. So HIT we're going to talk about in a second. There's two types. There's the immediate type that's probably not really HIT, and there's the autoimmune HIT, and I just will mention it briefly, give you some good references. Osteoporosis. We always said that you only saw osteoporosis if you used heparin for a long term. In oncology patients, we use heparin for long term. So osteoporosis is certainly a risk that we need to consider in patients that are on prolonged anticoagulation with heparin. Heparin-induced thrombocytopenia, we know that heparin can bind platelet factor 4, and that platelet factor 4 and heparin form an antibody, you get an immunologic response to it, and causes HIT, which is both thrombosis and thrombocytopenia. So when you get that antibody formed, it actually causes both platelet activation that causes the thrombosis, as well as an increase in clearance of platelets, and that's the thrombocytopenia. HIT can occur within 4 to 7 days of starting heparin, but think of our patients that have cancer. They have seen heparin so many times before that you can see HIT almost immediately in a patient who has received heparin in the past. So HIT should be something that you would consider if someone has a decrease in platelets of greater than 50%, if they've been on heparin for a little while, or if they have had it in the past. The treatment, because of time, discontinuation of all heparin, and then initiation of a different agent. You don't want to use warfarin in the initial management of HIT, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Bleeding with heparin, that's there, and it's also in the NCCN guidelines, so just want to remind you that when you talk about reversal, it depends on when the heparin was given, how much was given. So there's not like a set dose, so I would never ask a question, how much protamine do you give? It depends very much on what the dose of heparin that you gave. Management, these are some of the issues with heparin to consider. The key thing that this is where you use it with patients that don't fit into the low molecular weight heparin use. Low molecular weight heparin. We talked a little bit about it already. Its main effects is on thrombin and factor 10A. More factor 10A than thrombin. It's a smaller molecule, more predictable. You know this. You give it sub-Q. It has good effects. The key thing, the key risk with this is that it's renally eliminated. And so where this is an issue, not as only in those patients that have renal dysfunction, but in patients whose renal function is changing. So patients who have been on low molecular weight heparin need to be moved off if they are having changing of their renal function because the anticoagulation effect may change. Here are the two products that are commercially available and the dose for both thromboprophylaxis as well as VTE. For enoxaparin, you can see it's twice a day dosing. I think many of you will have seen that after a patient's been on twice a day for a month for the initial treatment, that you will often change to a once a day dosing for convenience. Monitoring, I think we've hit most of these things. Factor 10A can be used to monitor, but it's not a good way to monitor for anticoagulation effect. Where it's used is in patients that are at high risk of clotting or bleeding. So when you have patients that are obese and you're giving a huge dose and you're worried that you're overdosing because you're basing on weight, you may use a factor 10A level to get an idea that you're in a range that is safe. Same thing with renal dysfunction, same thing with pediatric patients and pregnancy. These are the factor A levels I just gave, the ones that are looked at. This is 4-hour post-dose. You'll read a lot about getting a trough effect. 4-hour post-dose is really one of the best times that you can get it and that you can see when they're within range. Clinical considerations. So where the real benefit of this agent comes is that when we talk about the use, it's been shown to be beneficial. The problem that comes is people don't want to inject themselves. So I ran an anticoag clinic for 5 years, and people would tell me, and the doc I worked with, who is wonderful, would say, low molecular weight heparin, low molecular weight heparin. And people would say, no, no. So not taking low molecular weight heparin and giving that to them and taking something that's not as good that they will take, well, that's the treatment option that you sometimes have to make a decision. Okay, factor 10A inhibitors. The key thing about these factor 10A inhibitors is that the use in oncology has been limited. The target is factor 10A. These are the agents, fondaparinux, sub-Q, the other three oral, fondaparinux, data in oncology, the other three, not necessarily in oncology. Saying that, knowing that you'll probably see them used, it's important to at least talk about some of the issues with them. Fondaparinux, the good thing with it is that you can do it once a day, it has a long half-life. The bad thing with it, you can use it once a day, it has a long half-life. That means if you're bridging somebody, it's a real problem. There's a real big push for fondaparinux when it first came out because of pricing. Now that pricing differential makes it maybe not as good. The great thing about fondaparinux to put in your head is that you have a very low risk of hit. So when a patient that has a risk of hit, this is an agent to consider. This just shows you, I have a lot of these diagrams that compare them because I think they're really helpful, and you can see just the three agents compared because I like those. I like tables. Told you, new job, had some time, made some tables. Okay, dosing is based on weight, and the dosing is different for different indications. Let's talk about the direct oral anticoagulants that inhibit factor 10A. These are direct. They have a direct effect on factor 10A. They are not indirect like heparin and like low molecular weight heparin. They are more consistent in their efficacy, and that is why they have really taken over in many clinical situations, except perhaps oncology. These are the three agents compared. They are all not used in the same way. A couple key factors to look at is the bioavailability is different. Rivaroxaban you need to take with food. If you look at renal elimination, you can see there's some differences. And the drug interaction. So there's a number of drug interactions, not your warfarin drug interactions, but certainly drug interactions. These are advantages and disadvantages that I think we've mentioned. And then let's go to the direct thrombin inhibitors. So this effect is mainly on thrombin, so APTT will be affected. These are the agents. Now in this case, these are the IV, and this is the oral. If you look at dabigatran, it in itself is not an anticoagulant. It needs to be converted to its active agent. And one of the big things about dabigatran that's of importance is that it's really poorly bioavailable. How it's packaged, it needs an acidic environment to be absorbed. It needs to be absorbed and then it's converted to its active agent. So one of the key things is how it's formulated is that it's in, on these pellets, and if you open the capsule, if you open them and break them, you get increased bioavailability. So here's the bioavailability, 6.5%. When you chew or crush, it goes up to 75%. And your effect is anticoagulation. So just be really aware of that because it's an important consideration in this drug. You can see there's renal elimination. So again, a drug that's difficult to use in a patient with renal insufficiency. And this just looks at all of the DOACs together just to give you an idea of some of the differences. An old oral anticoagulant, that's what I named it. And this is warfarin. And I'm not going to go over it too much except for some key factors I just want to point out. So I thought this was really clever, but of course I was bored in my office. So this explains how it works. And this is my favorite part. So this is your precursor to your clotting factors. This is your clotting factors. In order to get your clotting factors, you get a carboxylation, and you require reduced vitamin K. So you give the reduced vitamin K, it's utilized, and then you get oxidized vitamin K, and you recycle this so it can keep happening. Warfarin blocks the recycling of that vitamin K, so you can't make clotting factors. So when you use warfarin, again, it's not a direct effect. It doesn't, like the other ones, it doesn't break down the clot. It just decreases the formation of clotting factors, so you decrease the propagation of the clot. And how long it takes to work depends on how much clotting factor that you have. So that's one of the key points. When you take away warfarin, you've already blocked that for a while, so you'll still see effect. The key thing I always want to talk about is that it blocks not only these clotting factors, but it also blocks regulatory anticoagulant proteins. So remember from this picture, these are your procoagulants, and if you block that, what you actually get is you can actually get clotting by blocking the formation of protein CNS when you start the drug. So you never start warfarin without using something else to block that initial increased risk of thrombosis. So that's why you don't start warfarin and then later add something else on or just continue the warfarin. It's really important to realize that risk. So some of you remember the purple toe syndrome that used to see with that people used to report with warfarin. A lot of it is because of that clotting. Warfarin is a racemic mixture. It's the S warfarin is more effective, more active. The key reason I show you this is because the R enemer and the S enemer are broken down differently, and therefore there are differences in drug interactions and also in genomic metabolism of warfarin. And this just talks about some of the initiation. Because I have about 5 minutes, what I'm going to do, because we went through all the drugs, I think the warfarin things, I'm just going to keep some key things I want as we go through this, kind of like a movie. Key things I want to make sure I'm emphasize is when you start warfarin, you always get an INR. Always. Always. To assume you know what someone's ability to clot is by looking at them, to assume it's one, can be overdosing in this patient population. So patients that have bad eating habits, people that have lost a lot of weight, people with diarrhea, often will have a high INR. So a baseline INR is essential. Responses to warfarin fluctuate over time, so don't get confident that you can just give a dose and it will work. And you all know that we monitor INR, but a key factor is anything that will change the dose needs to be communicated. And the only way to do that is not to wait till you call them, but to make sure they call you. So developing a relationship with that patient or family member or caregiver to make sure they call you. Worst thing that ever happened to me in my career, I would say, is a patient who I saw in clinic for warfarin, made a dose adjustment. He then went to his physician's appointment, and they got put on ketoconazole and dexamethasone, which totally increases it. Now, my note was already in the chart for the first time in my life before that note was in the chart. Had no way of knowing that. And if that patient hadn't called, I never would have known, and he would have been toxic. So it's really important to make the patient and the caregiver the key people that coordinate. I want to get to management considerations. Contraindications. Contraindications can be absolute or relative. They can be permanent, or they may be changing. So these contraindications may change over time. So someone who couldn't get anticoagulation may be able to get it with other changes. So that's there. Prophylaxis. The at-risk population that we know are people that are not ambulatory, and that has been historically patients in the hospital. But as we move patients out of the hospital, I think we need to look at those patients that are not ambulatory, that are recovering post-surgery, and the potential benefit of using prolonged anticoagulation. Right now, the recommendations are people that have pelvic or ovarian high-risk abdominal surgeries. The other high risk that we know in oncology are patients with myeloma receiving the immunomodulating agents with dexamethasone and or chemotherapy. Therapy of VTE, the guidelines that are published by ASCO, NCCN, as well as that by in the CHEST are good documents. There are also some guidance documents that I've put here that will give you some nice indications of the people that don't fit the normal guidelines. So VTE with cancer, we treat them, the recommendation right now is that we treat them with either low molecular weight heparin, unfractionated heparin or fondaparinux, and then consider chronic therapy with low molecular weight heparin or warfarin. That's the recommendation today. What you won't see up here is those direct oral anticoagulants. So if you look at acute management, they're not recommended, that's what I just said. If you look at acute management of VTE that is not cancer, so this says doesn't say cancer on it, you can see there are a number of other options that are used. So if you're working with people that deal with VTE that don't know your cancer population, they may recommend use of some of these new agents. But at this time, the studies that looked, and there's great studies. In fact, this review on this page does a nice job of looking at all these newer anticoagulants and looking at the data. About 2-7% of the population were cancer population. So that's why at this time, even though I think in my head there probably is a very, there's a role, we don't know what that role is. Chronic management, low molecular weight heparin or warfarin, and the direct oral anticoagulants are not recommended. This is the CLOT study. I will go to the bottom line. It showed that low molecular weight heparin used long-term is better than using a vitamin K antagonist such as warfarin. Okay, just a couple key things that I want to make sure that we talk about. Duration of treatment. When we talk about duration of treatment, we usually talk 3 to 6 months. The duration of the cancer is the duration of the treatment in a patient with a VTE related to the cancer. It is one of the most challenging things to talk to a patient about because a patient wants to know how long am I going to be on this. And to say, I don't know, when you say 6 months and their disease comes back, then you have to say longer than 6 months. So they're on anticoagulation while they have the disease. And I think that's really challenging to talk about. Catheter-associated thrombus, as long as they have the catheter in place, and a minimum of 3 months. Okay. This was a market scan database analysis for newly diagnosed cancer, and they found that warfarin was still the most commonly used anticoagulation, not low molecular weight heparin, despite the data. Now, is anybody here surprised about that? See, I'm not. So if just yell out, what would be the reason that you think? People still, there you go. And so one of the big reasons is cost. What's the second reason people don't like to use low molecular weight heparins? Sticking themselves in. And I have a friend who's second clot with cancer, second clot, and she was on low molecular weight heparin and couldn't wait to get back on warfarin. I don't think that's a phrase I've ever said, can't wait to get back on warfarin. So even though the guidelines are there, people are tending still to go with warfarin because of those social issues that are very important. And the other thing is there is an increased use of the direct oral anticoagulants, even though the data is not there in studies. So even though they're not in guidelines, definitely people are starting to use those factor 10A inhibitors as well as direct thrombin inhibitors. When not to consider active treatment, I put this up because I'm sure many of you people see patients end of life. And one of the big questions is, do you take this off? You take off anticoagulation when you're not going to increase problems associated from taking it off. If you have someone with a clot in their leg and it's painful, taking away anticoagulation makes the clot bigger and more painful. So taking away anticoagulation may be good at end of life, but it may not be. So considering that is really something important when you're looking at a patient and taking off for palliation reasons. When to place filter, I think we've talked a little bit about this. This is the risk associated from filters. So really important that if you can do retrievable filters, that's where you would go. Thrombolic agents for VTE is becoming in vogue again. Used to think of it when we used these agents systemically. Now with catheter-directed, less of a risk. And so there are some indications that are beneficial with these agents. So I put that in, and again, those are in NCCN, and here's your risks. Okay, those people who have clot despite what you think is good anticoagulation. The first issue is to evaluate if you are having good anticoagulation and to look and see if they're taking their drugs, if they're taking them how they're supposed to be doing it, and then optimizing the dose, and then to switch to another agent if needed. These are the reversal agents. I really recommend that instead of memorizing reversal agents, you use the NCCN guidelines because they put not only the risk, but also the relative risk of bleeding with how you do reversal. And I think any of you who work with warfarin know that an INR of 4 is not great. An INR of 10 scares you to death. But if you're not bleeding with an INR of 10 and the INR is coming down, that's a whole different risk factor for reversal. And when you reverse somebody with warfarin, what you're seeing, unfortunately, is that you're going to have long-term effective reversal.
This concludes this podcast from the 2016 JADPRO Live at App Show Conference. To view the presentation material or see other topics of interest, please visit advancedpractitioner.com/sessions2016. To claim continuing educational credit for these activities, visit education.annenberg.net/JPL16-sessions.